All right, Acts chapter 9, starting in verse 32. We are going to get back to the church as a whole and not just Saul. We had a little detour there. But again, that still fits in the story because God is reaching the nations here. But Acts chapter 9, verse 32. Now as Peter went here and there among them all, he came down also to the saints who lived at Lydda. There he found a man named Aeneas, bedridden for 8 years, who was paralyzed. And Peter said to him, Aeneas, Jesus Christ heals you. Rise, make your bed. And immediately he rose, and all the residents of Lydda and Sharon saw him, and they turned to the Lord. Now there was in Joppa a disciple named Tabitha, which translated means Dorcas, or gazelle. That sounds better. She was full of good works and acts of charity. In those days she became ill and died, and when they had washed her, they laid her in an upper room. Since Lydda was near Joppa, the disciples, hearing that Peter was there, sent two men to him, urging him, "Please come to us without delay." So Peter rose and went with them, and when he arrived, they took him to the upper room. All the widows stood beside him, weeping and showing tunics and other garments that Dorcas had made while she was with them. But Peter put them all outside and knelt down and prayed. And turning to the body, he said, Tabitha, arise. And she opened her eyes. And when she saw Peter, she sat up. And he gave her his hand and raised her up. Then calling the saints and widows. Verse 41, he gave her his hand and raised her up. Then calling the saints and widows, he presented her alive, and it became known throughout all Joppa, and many believed in the Lord, and he stayed in Joppa for many days with one Simon the Tanner. All right. So a quick geography lesson. This is Israel. This is the Mediterranean Sea, the Jordan River. We have kind of Judea, Samaria, and Galilee as you go north. So Lydda and Joppa are in Judea. Lydda would be like a county seat. It's a political, governmentally important city to Judea, still not part of Samaria, but it's right up there by it. So, as Peter was going to and fro, he's going around two different small towns and churches. He ends up going to Lydda and then taken out to the coast to Joppa. This region right here on the coast is called Sharon. So when they talk about the people of Joppa and the region of Sharon, or I'm sorry, Lydda and the region of Sharon, that's a smaller region in here. Okay. When you hear these two stories, what's your initial thoughts? What jumps out? Why are these stories important? How much preaching was going on? Because so far, all of the work of the ministry has been primarily preaching. Where's the preaching at?
My question is, how did he know to do that?
How did Peter know to do that? Okay, we're going to have some questions, and I think that's an excellent question. I have always wrestled with that. How did they know to ask him? She's already dead. Okay. How did Peter know? How to heal and raise? How did they know to ask? Any other thoughts or questions that arise from this?
I think how to heal, he saw Christ, but if to heal. I think that's
the question. Okay. There's a question of if. Let me ask you another question. If you were to take the names out of the story and you were to just say, hey, there was a guy who did some healing, the story would sound like one of Jesus' things, right? Except that it says Peter did this and Peter did that. If you were to say Jesus did this, it would sound believable. It sounds like a Jesus ministry thing. Okay, so we're going to say there's a connection to Jesus' ministry somehow. Anything else? Oh, I already asked, where's the preaching? Any other thoughts? Okay. Is this evangelistic? And the reason I ask is, in verse 32, and as Peter was or went here and there among them all, he came down also to the saints who lived at Lydda. Okay, I would suggest this might not be evangelism, which is kind of how up to now looks. But instead, it almost looks just like a shepherding ministry. Would that be an appropriate thing to say? He seems to be going around to the churches, not necessarily missions trips. Anything else that we need to point out while we're here? That's true. It's not clear. It just says they believed. Anything else? All right. So Peter is going here and there among them all. Along with this, how did Peter know to heal? How did Peter know to go in and out among them all? If this is a shepherding ministry, what are we seeing in Peter that he's left Jerusalem, okay, and he's going to each of these towns, finding the saints who were there, and he's doing something? We could probably guess about what he's doing, but why is he going? Okay, I would have to say that that's at least part of it, that the church in Jerusalem had been scattered because of the persecution, specifically dealing with Stephen. I think it's important to note, probably not all of the people who were saved at Pentecost stayed in Jerusalem. Probably they went back home. So, remember the map. How much of the map... You know, if we were to put a pin in the homes of Christians, how much of the map could we cover with 5,000 believers? Probably a little bit of it, and outside of it as well. So, even just with that, even if we don't count the persecution, he's got a lot to cover. And then when you add to it the persecution, he has some real ministry to do. So what then is the ministry of Peter to these churches? Because all of the specific statements of the apostles' work have to do with their specific calling, and Jesus' calling on their life was to testify to the resurrection of Jesus.
But Peter had a specific calling to feed the sheep from Jesus.
Okay.
So I would assume that this is that.
Okay. Anything else? What does it mean to feed sheep? What? So, when we see his evangelistic work, it is specifically scripturally based. It is specifically preaching based. Does that ministry change when he's dealing with the church as opposed to non-believers? So you preach to get them saved. What do you do now that they are saved and they are the church? Well, you continue teaching and preaching. You continue testifying to the resurrection of Jesus. Because what do you feed sheep? In this case, you feed them the shepherd. The only case in all of history where the sheep eat the shepherd. But that was what Jesus had told them. So, he is still teaching and preaching. Okay. So we have teaching and preaching. It's a knowledge, understanding, belief, doctrinal thing. What else is he doing?
Obviously healing.
Okay, we have healings. And we already said it. We're going to call it encouragement. And I think that's an important one to point out, at least those two together, because the people at Joppa knew that Peter was there and they asked him to come because they knew that he could do something. Something. And unfortunately, that's kind of all we've got. He can do something. When we see Jesus in his teaching ministry, how often does it say that he spent the rest of the day healing the people? He was casting out demons and he was healing for the rest of the day. How important was that part of his ministry?
Well, it seems like in Joppa, he heals, raises one lady from the dead, and the whole town is converted.
Okay. So it has value because it does relate to eternal souls. It does relate even to preaching. It's still been part of a preaching ministry, and we see that in Jesus' time also. The signs and the miracles were there to authenticate the messenger and the message. So we have that aspect also. I think there's one thing that's super easy to miss, because in the cultural swing of things, we go from we're just caring about people to just viewing the gospel, and yet what we see in Jesus is a compassionate care for people. So even though we spend a lot of time going, it's about the message, Jesus' interaction with people was one of compassionate care. So when we see Peter going about doing his thing, we see the Spirit of God that overflowed in the life of Christ in compassionate care, overflowing in Peter to compassionate care also. And it's super important to notice, it's the same Spirit that's driving Peter to do these things. He has this compassionate care going on. So he's going here and there. He's teaching and preaching. He's healing. He's encouraging. All right. He found a man named Aeneas. Was Aeneas saved? We have no idea. It says that he was going to the saints and then he found Aeneas. We don't know. Verse 35 starts a little bit weird. It says, all of the residents of Lydda and Sharon saw him and they turned to the Lord. Probably not 100%, but it was big enough for Luke to say, they all turned to the Lord. So, back in 33, he found a man named Aeneas, bedridden for 8 years, who was paralyzed. Okay? How paralyzed are you after 8 years? Let's say you found somebody who got hurt last week. Does he still have a pretty good chance of maybe rebuilding some strength? Maybe. 8 years ago, he's as good as he's ever going to get. Okay, it's important to note, he is beyond help. He's beyond hope. Now, we don't know why he was paralyzed, but he was paralyzed. And he was in a bed of some kind. But 34, Peter said to him, Aeneas, Jesus Christ heals you. Rise and make your bed. And immediately he rose. How did Peter know to do that? Maybe. So we maybe have the Spirit in Peter telling him to do it. Because one option is that Peter has the power all by himself. He can point the power of God anywhere he wants to, and it is going to work. My favorite example of this is Elisha. He He's crossed back over the Jordan River, and he's going about his way, and these kids make fun of him for his bald head. Mm-hmm. What does he do? He calls out some she-bears, and they come and maul the children. How did he know that would work? Have you ever tried that? Have you ever tried performing a miracle?
And it hasn't worked, I'll tell you that.
The kids still make fun of you for your bald head. I see.
I've tried.
How do they know it's going to work? Why do we have no answers for these things?
Mark, when Jesus sent out the 12 and then also the 70, weren't they instructed to cast out demons, to heal the sick? I mean, hadn't they had some experience already? This wasn't brand new.
What made the ministry of the 70 worthwhile? You remember what Jesus had told them when he sent them out? He sent them out with authority. Whose authority?
His.
Which is the Father's authority. So catch this. If you have the authority to get something done, you can make it happen. It sounds weird. Peter didn't need told to heal that guy. He just needed to go and do it. Now, when the 70 got back, by the way, this is right before the feeding of the 5,000. The 70 get back, and what do they tell Jesus? Even the demons obey us. Wait a second. I sent you out of my authority, but the demons obey you? Okay. If you're that good, feed 5,000 people. You see the connection there? You think you have authority to heal and cast out demons, but you can't feed people. We're not even talking about something inherently miraculous within the person. They're just eating. Can you feed these people? No, we can't. So Jesus does. And they get the opportunity to take part in it also. So they not only take the authority of Christ, but also the provision of Christ to the people. The feeding of the 5,000 is the object lesson after the coming back of the 70. You don't do anything without God's authority. But with God's authority, even the demons listen. But are they listening to you? Or are they listening to the authority that Christ has? So, even the demons obey us, was their comment on the 70. But here with Peter, in 34, Peter said to him, Aeneas, Jesus Christ heals you. He didn't say, I heal you. He didn't say, I'm going to heal you. Or I say, take up your mat and walk, which is kind of what Jesus says. He understands where the authority comes from, but he also understands that he bears that authority also. Jesus Christ heals you. That is mind-blowing that Peter carries the authority of God in the healing of really whoever he wants. That's craziness. So here we have Peter continuing Jesus' ministry. So, we have heard some people in verse 34 back up the scriptural reference of cleanliness is next to godliness. When you wake up, you make your bed. Right? That's a joke. Did you know that people actually think that cleanliness is next to godliness is a verse in the Bible? I always thought it was a joke. I've talked to people who think that that's a verse in the Bible. I got nothing for that. It's not, Steve. Okay. Why would he tell him to make his bed? Which, by the way, it's probably not fold the sheets, tuck them in under the mattress. It's probably take the mat that you're sitting on and fold it or roll it up. What do you mean it's a done deal?
You ain't going back to it.
It's taken care of and finished. It's a done deal. How much faith would that guy have if he's like, okay, well, I'm just going to leave this here for when this fails? Okay, so let's say this guy has some level of faith. Did his faith heal him? Well, in a way, he had the faith that Christ's authority heals him, so he got up and he rolled up his mat and he went about his life. But did his faith heal him? No. His faith proved that Christ healed him. So would he have had faith if he left his mat down on the ground? No. If you leave the opportunity to go back to the way things were, it's a revelation that there's no solid faith there. You're just going to try it out for a while. Instead, you roll up the mat and you take it up somewhere else. The next time you lay on it, it's to sleep. It's not to live. So he rose, and all the residents of Lydda and Sharon saw him, and they turned to the Lord. Which, by the way, we're probably not talking about hundreds of thousands of people. We're talking about a region. Cool. Now, in Joppa, there was a disciple named Tabitha.
And this may be a rabbit trail we don't want to go on. But I always struggle with, same author, here Luke's showing us that an amazing thing took place, and people went, wow. And their lives changed. And then the same author back in Luke who writes about the rich man and Lazarus and the rich guys in hell going, just send somebody, do something amazing, and I guarantee you my brothers will believe. And it's just, I know I'm not understanding. One of them I'm not understanding correctly, but I just wonder what the difference is there that's shut down immediately, and yet this seems to show that, man, these miracles change people's lives.
So let's see if we can come up with a question for it. Mm-hmm. Were the people saved because of the miracle? Because it seems related.
It just seems that...
seems related.
The miracles just seem to impact in a significant way, And at least with the rich man and Lazarus, the miracle is just, no, that's not going to happen, because if they don't believe what Moses has done.
Okay. So we're going to write Moses for a second, and we're going to say that we're talking about the writings of Moses. Okay. So I don't know if everybody caught that. Rich man and Lazarus. Lazarus tells Abraham... No, the rich man tells Abraham, send Lazarus back to my brothers and tell them about how bad it is for me, and then they can believe, and that way they're not stuck where I am. They can be with Abraham. And Abraham's response was, they have Moses. If they don't believe Moses, they won't believe anybody else. They won't believe miraculous signs or if somebody comes back from the dead or any of that stuff. So here we have a miraculous sign, and people did believe. Whereas Abraham told the rich man, even if you did have signs, they wouldn't believe. And yet here they did believe. So what relationship do miracles have with salvation?
That the Holy Spirit can use them.
What part is a miracles mindset missing? The teachings of Moses. This is where salvation is found. The teachings of Moses, pointing out God's plan of a Savior for his people. How do miracles relate with Moses? They're there to point back to the message. So when we talk about the area of Sharon or Lydda, we have to know that there's been preaching going on there. There's already a church there. Peter showed up there. He was well known there. when we have this guy get healed and people saw him, do you think this guy had something to say about the message? You think he was just walking down the street, they saw him and went, whoa, I'm saved. Or do you think maybe they talked to him? Did that guy have a testimony about the power of God in his own life? So they're related, but I agree. The rich man and Lazarus story is an interesting one. Because they were told, even with miracles, they wouldn't believe.
That was borne out with Jesus raising Lazarus from the dead. A few days later, there's people not believing.
Right. Right. So, the how you get saved is actually a very long conversation, but we got to know that the Spirit is using stuff.
But God knows hearts. And I guess in my own terminology, why waste a miracle on people who aren't going to believe no matter what? But he did.
All of Jesus' miracles were to the unsaved who didn't believe. So I agree. In fact, we're even told you don't give your pearls to pigs. They're gonna trample them in the mud and they're gonna attack you. So we have that issue. Brad, were you gonna say something earlier?
Oh, but I can.
People who raised their hand first.
Well, I'm just thinking in Mark we see the progressive nature of the revelation, and as Peg said. Well, why do that? Well, that was Jesus' whole ministry was doing that to people who didn't get it. And as he went along, more and more got revealed to where at the end, now that we can look at the end after Jesus' work on the cross is finished, we can say that now all these pieces are in place. The truth of Jesus Christ and his work on the cross is in place to where now maybe we see, that's why we see a different response now, because Jesus said before, well, it isn't my time yet.
So what are we missing? It's not his time, all that kind of stuff. We're missing the plan. They didn't believe because they weren't ready to believe. That wasn't part of God's plan. Because now, granted, in Acts, we see Peter and Paul and all the apostles, they're building the church. Wrong. Who's building the church? God's building the church. He's using the apostles. He's using miracles. He's using all that kind of stuff. There's a means for how he's building the church. So we're missing what we don't know is the plan, but we're not called to know the plan. We're called to work. Peter didn't know everyone was in Sharon was going to get saved.
Well, Judas Iscariot, he walked around with Jesus for 3 years. He sold him out for the 30 pieces of silver, and that was part of God's plan also. But in the long run, his heart, he didn't believe either. So, you know, I mean, if he can be there right with Jesus teaching all the time, 24/7, still not believe. You know, there's got to be something that's going on more than just, it's in the heart. It's not just, you know, we're going to believe or we're not going to believe or it's my choice or whatever, you know.
In Jesus' high priestly prayer, he prayed about Judas. You know, I haven't lost any except the one that was designed to be lost. And yet, Judas chose. He chose to reject. Could you imagine his judgment when he stood before the Father? You saw every single miracle and you heard every single message and you still rejected it. That would be a terrible moment.
What about him being designed to do that, though?
What about him being designed to do that?
I don't know. I just think that's important to note.
So, Judas, condemned for his rejection of Christ, was ordained by the Father to reject Christ. So we have a problem that Christianity has wrestled with for 2,000 years that we can't answer today. because they both stand. Okay? He was ordained by God to do the very things that he did, and he was held accountable for those decisions that he had made. So we have an apparent tension, and in our limited ability, it's a hard one to wrestle through. And there's been some major fights over the centuries over that one. All right. We're going to have to move on, though. We got onto Judas. Okay. God is still building his church. He still has a plan for all of this. The message absolutely has to be there. Whether there's signs or not signs, whatever, the message has to be there. But then we get into seeing a little bit of the church. Verse 36, now there was in Joppa a disciple named Tabitha, which translated means Dorcas. She was full of good works and acts of charity. What kind of person are we talking about? She sounds like a nun. Did we just find somebody who lives in a convent? No? Why not? They hadn't been invented yet. Do we suffer from... I'm hoping that we don't suffer from an odd view of the early church. You know what life looked like in Joppa? Normal life. It looked like dudes going to work and ladies helping out one another. It looked like real life. Okay, that's not where the Shekinah glory was. It's not like the Holy Spirit was visible and doves are landing on everyone. It's just life. Okay, she was busy. She was full of good works and acts of charity. In those days she became ill and died, and when they had washed her, they laid her in an upper room. By the way, is she dead? How dead is she?
Real dead.
Real dead. Fully and completely dead. There's no reviving her, right? She's already been washed and prepared for burial. Verse 38, since Lydda was near Joppa, the disciples, hearing that Peter was there, sent two men to him, urging him, please come to us without delay. What were they expecting him to do?
Do what he did. Maybe pray at a funeral. I think that's what it was. I don't know.
It could be that they were just asking for encouragement.
Yeah,
because if they have washed her and laid her in the upper room, this is a mourning. This is a wake. This is a wake. They know she's dead, and they're planning on burying her. So I don't think they're expecting him to raise her. I think they're expecting him to just come and
be there.
Verse 39. So Peter rose and went with them, and when he arrived, they took him to the upper room. Which, by the way, is he already in Lydda doing a ministry? Yeah. He's already doing something. Right? Do you remember, after the feeding of the 5,000, do you remember what Jesus told his apostles, or his disciples? We need to go across the lake and rest. Okay. He was into doing that. But do you know how they got to the feeding of the 5,000? He had told them, we need to go across the lake and rest. Well, they get there and the crowd is already there. So he was already doing something. In fact, he had rest in mind. Now, if you're actively doing something and you get pulled off to do something else, that's tolerable. But what happens if you finally get your afternoon off? What happens if you finally get your nap and there's the problem? There's the 5,000 people that need you to feed them. Which sometimes it feels like that for my wife. Okay. 9,000, is that what you said? Okay. So he's already doing something, but he rose and he went with him. We see the heart of Christ in Peter, which is a different man. That was not the kind of... Peter was not that kind of person in the Gospels. He was an angry little man. Okay? But he rose and he went with them. And when he arrived, they took him to the upper room. All the widows stood beside him, weeping and showing tunics and other garments that Dorcas had made while she was with them. Right? This is a wake. They're mourning for her. Look at all the great things that she had done. But Peter put them all outside and knelt down and prayed and turned to the body and said, "Tabitha, arise."
How long did that took?
Well, first of all, how many people are we talking about? Probably not talking about hundreds. Let's say a dozen. We got 12 people in there, and he tells them to leave. You're supposed to be here mourning with us. You're supposed to be talking about how great these garments are that she had made in her life. And he comes in and kicks them out.
Not very sensitive.
Not very sensitive, that jerk. What's he doing in there? Okay, he prays and he turns to the body and he says, "Tabitha, arise." What does that sound like? Tabitha, arise.
Lazarus, come out.
We see a continuation of Jesus' ministry here in Peter, and Peter understands that it's Jesus' ministry. He calls her by name, and he calls her up. She opened her eyes, and when she saw Peter, she sat up. And he gave her his hand. Okay, is there any... I don't know how the Mosaic law would deal with a dead body that came back to life, but you're not allowed to touch a dead body. Okay, Peter was raised in that atmosphere. He's got 30 years of knowing there's a way to do things, and here he is. He's drawn to take her by the hand.
She's no longer dead.
She's no longer dead.
That's what Jesus always did too, though. The little girl and Peter's mother-in-law.
He was always touching them. He takes him by the hand, all that kind of stuff. The woman with the issue of blood should not have touched anyone. And yet, she got to touch Jesus. It's crazy. So he takes her by the hand, and he raised her up. Then, calling the saints and widows, he presented her alive. Awake into a celebration. That would have been an emotional roller coaster. And it became known throughout all Joppa, and many believed in the Lord. And he stayed in Joppa for many days with one Simon, a tanner.
I always try to put my brain back into where these guys are, because it's easy to kind of sit here with our 21st century. If I go somewhere, there's churches and there's nothing new really. And to me, it's just kind of cool how God works. That I live in this town. I've followed Judaism all my life, and now I've got some buddies coming back that are telling me about this new thing, and it kind of makes sense. You know, and they said that God did some neat things in Jerusalem, and so you kind of go, well, are you imagining that, or are you embellishing, or you know? And so it's like they're laying this groundwork, and then God goes just for some additional affirmation, and he does two amazing miracles that I can't help but think just reaffirm what all those people that came from Jerusalem were saying. It just reaffirmed that, and when they saw that affirmation, they went, "Yeah, you know that stuff that you've been telling us? You're right.
Yeah,
this is where we." Yeah. So it's just kind of cool how, I mean, my guess is that those guys came back from Jerusalem and were telling everybody, and people were kind of skeptical. I mean, I would be. I've been following this religion all my life, and you want me to tweak it now?
Right. Mm-hmm. And yet, who can? Who can argue with Aeneas walking and Tabitha alive?
Exactly. And you take that piece and you add it to what those guys and gals were probably saying throughout the city, and it's like, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So why wasn't this, why didn't this turn into a system? All right, we got the region of Sharon. Next, we're going to go to this other region over here. We're going to find a paralyzed guy. And we're gonna preach for a couple of weeks, and then we're gonna heal him, and then everybody's going to get saved. The plan? We do have God's plan here. We never even have a hint of that until later on in Paul's ministry. And you end up with things like Paul would touch a towel and send it to somebody else, and they would touch it and be healed. That's weird. Why would you even try that? We have the issue of faith. We have the issue of God, Christ's authority being played out there. And yet here we see in Peter, I don't know that we can structure his life too much yet. I don't know that we can lay out the groundwork for any kind of church structure or missionary structure or anything like that. He's just helping people. The overflow of Peter's heart to help people becomes very apparent. The fact that he actually left Jerusalem to go to all these little towns and churches shows a heart of Peter that is a caring heart that we haven't seen in Peter really before. I don't know how to ask this. What is Peter's intent? Is he out to get people saved? Because Luke kind of writes it that way. They went and did this and all the people got saved. And they went and did this and all the people got saved. I often wonder what was in Peter's mind. Like, why did he go out? I mean, we can guess why he went to Joppa. He was asked to go.
Jesus told him that you're Peter, and on this rock I will build my church. So I wonder if his call was to go to different little places was to introduce him to the gospel to little towns. And he got saved because it was God's plan for him to.
So what happens if he's only going out of duty?
Well, I don't know if it'd be duty, it'd be more like God's call.
Okay, we'll get to that one first, because sometimes it looks like duty. Like, I'm going to go here and I'm going to preach the resurrection of Jesus Christ because that's my call. Anybody sold on that one?
The word of Christ was preached, though, even if it was out of duty.
Okay, so the work of the ministry, preaching, the gospel, healing ministries, all still happened. People still got saved. Is Peter serving his dutiful purpose?
I think it's a love for Christ that drives him and a fear of the Lord. He recognizes who Jesus is and the Father's authority. And he is responding to that. And he's responding to the position that Jesus put him in and the responsibility that he was given.
So, it could be a love for Christ. Let me go, offer another option first. It could be a love for people.
Doesn't that come out in a love for
people? Let's say it's the first one. Instead of it coming out of a love for Christ, he's loving people first. Do we see that in Peter? Because he's healing people. He's preaching the message, and if he was people-oriented, they need to hear that message so they can get saved. I'm just going to offer that up here. Because we want to say he's people-oriented, but... And somebody's already brought it up. Jesus' conversation with Peter. Feed my sheep. Feed my sheep was the statement. What was the question that got to the statement? Do you love me? Do you love Christ? The love for Christ compels him to love people. Now, was it his duty to do that? Yes. Sure, it was his duty to do that. Is that why he was out there? I would have to say no. His love for Christ. So, out of a love for Christ, we're going to do that. What does his love for Christ look like? You guys know that love isn't a thing, right? You can't jar it up. You can't condense it down. You have actions based on love, right? What was Peter's desire to see in his ministry that was for Christ? What was Peter doing that was for Christ? What does preaching the gospel have to do with it? It's about worshiping their king. Peter knows full well that a love for Christ draws as many people into his kingdom as we can so that he can be seen as a king worthy of worship. That is absolutely flipped over from a people-oriented mindset. Even though it looks a lot alike, if it's a devotion to your king out of a love for him, everything that you do is so that you're bringing people into his kingdom. So is he a missionary? Well, is he only a pastor? Well, no, not really. Is he only a healer? No. He's going to do anything and everything to show the greatness of this King Jesus. All right, they're coming in on us. We're going to pray. Dear God, I thank you for being with us this morning. I thank you for your word, for the opportunity to see how the ministry of Christ was continuing through the apostles. I pray that we would be able to see this heart of Peter and know that it wasn't just a duty that drove him to do these things, but it was a love for you. And I pray that we would learn what that love is really like in our own lives. And I pray in Jesus' name, amen.